Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in a world so full of chaos and madness and trolls and liars and thieves and scumbaggery and betrayal and demonization and etc. There's lots of etc., by the way. If you lose your sense of humour, you'll go frickin' nuts. A very special guest.
Wait, let me see if I can do that in the mafia impression, considering, you know, she's just that much of a gangster.
My very special guest is Suzanne Pozzo from OccupyCorporatism.com. Welcome back.
Hello.
What's on the news for today, Suzanne?
Well, you know, we've got this universal preschool program that Obama mentioned in his State of the Union address. And they want kids to go to school much earlier. They want to spend much more time, longer periods of time, indoctrinating your children, or my children. That's why my children are homeschooled. They want to make sure that the government funds everything so that they can have control over all of the programs. A gentleman named Grover Whiteburst from the Brookings Institute, that lovely globalist think tank, is Grover supporting this.
Grover. Isn't Grover like some kind of a Sesame Street character?
He is, and you would think that it would be that innocuous, but he's not. He's evil. He works for the Brookings.
Is he incidentally also a Bohemian Grover?
I don't know. I know that he works for a globalist think tank, so either he's really dumb and ignorant and doesn't realize what he's doing, or he does and he's got some evil mad scientist cackle.
Or he has some kind of a gun to his head.
Oh my God, yes. And everybody's busting in your door.
Mm. Well, anyway, continue.
So he's got these proposals that the government should have investments financially in pre-K programs. Federal funding should influence school curriculum to ensure that indoctrination is taught as a rule for evidence-based development. The federal-state partnership to influence communities by directing public school systems. Eliminating teacher unions by federalizing teachers' salaries with credit. Oh, don't worry. We'll just give you some credit. We're not actually going to pay you. Or, hey, if you don't do what we say, we're not going to pay you. The school districts will be under the thumb of the federal government in all its totality. And this is, you know, it's bad enough that we have indoctrination in our schools. But this is just cartoon insanity ridiculous.
Well, that's what the United States is all about now, isn't it?
Yes, entertainment.
So entertained and so uninformed.
Exactly, and that's how they want to keep them. You know, you've got the model UN, the UN, where kids can learn to be UN ambassadors and debate UN agendas. They're not learning about their constitutional republic. They're not learning about their rights or what was done to ensure that they had rights, or all the people since 1776 who have fought to make sure that they have their rights. They're being taught that they're global citizens and this is a global society and your resource is my resource and my resource is my resource. And you can only have it if you have enough pieces of paper to trade for it. And that's how we run things.
Yeah. What's yours is mine and what's mine's mine too.
Exactly. And I noticed last year when we had the Chicago teachers protesting, I wrote an article about that because when I dug into what they were actually protesting, it was the UN takeover of their schools. That if they didn't adhere to UN agenda that was being infiltrated into the curriculum and into the bureaucracy in the school as far as the principals and evaluations of teachers, that they would be just fired or let go with or without pay. Their tenure was, you know, it didn't matter anymore if they had the UN to follow, and that was it.
Well,
so of course.
It occurs to me that they're simply trying to brainwash a generation into being UN lovers and supporters so that when these children, when this generation grows up, they will not have known a Republic of the United States. They will not have known a constitution. They would have only known world government.
Absolutely. And so this initiative with Obama to put kids in school much earlier, you know, it's incredible that so many decades ago they found a really good reason to tear these children away from their parents for 8 hours a day to instruct them on how they should behave and how they should contribute to our society. What was approved and not. Mm. Now.
Yeah, well, look at it this way. With the technology that we've got now, just Skype alone, public schools are virtually a thing of the past, you know, or at least they frickin' well should be. Yet, the government's not doing any of that. They're not utilizing technology to free children from the drudgery of having to get up at a particular... I don't know about you, Suzanne, but I frickin' hated school. I hated every minute of it.
I did too. I didn't have a good time in school.
I mean, it just sucked. You know, everybody who you're hanging out with, you're only hanging out with them because you didn't want to be totally by yourself. And it kind of like forced me into this sort of social leech syndrome where I didn't necessarily 100% click with the people that I was hanging out with during lunchtimes or in class or whatever, but I just didn't really have much of a choice, and it was a hell of a lot better, of a better option than just being totally by myself and being a recluse and things like that. And that's not a good thing to teach kids, I think. I mean, and I learned differently after school what real friendship is actually about. It's about giving a frack about each other. It's about going the extra mile for each other. It's about being there for each other when you're absolutely desperately needed, not just being there because you don't really have any other choice. And I think this is the reason why none of the people that I was ever friends with in high school, primary school, elementary, whatever, are my friends today, because they weren't really my friends.
Absolutely. I didn't buy into what was popular. I chose to read books and eat my lunch by myself. And growing up in an area where there's a lot of cultures, what I found interesting was during lunchtime, everyone would naturally segregate. The Cubans would sit with the Cubans, the blacks would sit with the blacks, with the Mexican Hispanics would sit together, the whites would sit together. And nobody really, there was nothing nefarious going on. Like-minded liked like-minded. What made you more like me, I wanted to be around. And since I wasn't into, I went to a school that was a lot like 90210 for high school. And since I didn't really care about what was popular, I got to observe things more than participate. And I was perfectly fine with that. But like you said, the same thing happened for me. It wasn't until I got out of high school and I started actually making friends that I realized that how we treat other people is exactly what we get back. And if you are that person that everybody knows they can depend on and trust, then that will always come back to you. Anytime you ever need anything, there'll be a multitude of people who are willing to give it to you.
Yeah, provided you are friends with people who are actually your friends and not just, you know, using you or whatever. And, you know, that's happened to me many times. And the other thing I didn't like about high school was the fact that I didn't like the lessons that I was being taught. You know, it seemed really boring and pointless. And sure enough, other than basic math and basic English, I have not learned a single thing throughout my entire high school or university career that has ever been of any use whatsoever in any practical or philosophical or realistic manner.
That was a dilemma I realized for me when I sat down to homeschool my son, that beyond teaching him how to read and write and structure sentences and the proper way to write things and basic math skills, everything else is up for grabs. So I teach him a little bit of everything and try not to try to get him to have an open mind to the idea that we've got a lot of theories, and the information that's been disseminated down to us is not there for functionality. It's there to so we have trivial things to talk about, but we don't really know anything if we're paying attention to mainstream or paying attention to even the scientific studies that come out and the educational television and educational books. It's all really just for factoids. So you sound like what you're talking about.
Yeah. I think I do like factoids, you know. I mean, they do sometimes offer some very great insight as to how the world really is or how it really works. But in terms of, again, practical application, do you get taught how to create a product, start a business, or learn a trade in high school? And in most cases, not. So when you come out of school, what are you going to do? You're either going to go into a slave job that's unskilled, pays bugger all, and won't really advance your intelligence or anything. Maybe at best you'll learn some kind of a work ethic out of it. Provided you don't have a work ethic already, like if you were a pampered, bratty child of some description, then you'd learn, oh, suddenly I have to actually get my pull finger and do some work myself.
When I got to college, there was a strange phenomenon that happened here, and I don't know if it's the same for you over in New Zealand, but everything became a trade. A two-year or six-month or year-and-a-half course on how to fix something. There was no education. There was no higher thought. You were taught to perform a function. And I even bought into that. I became a paralegal and got a paralegal degree because it was easy, it was quick, it was cheap, and it would, you know, $70 an hour that's pretty good pay. Yeah, let's go for that. But it was only a two-week course. There's no way I should have or was able to learn everything I needed to know to actually perform the function well, to do the basic function, of course, but to be a good paralegal, to have an open mind and an understanding of what the legal system really is and how it's changed and been manipulated and redirected over the decades? Absolutely not. I got nothing like that. I just got training on how to write documents, how to write summons, petitions, complaints, answers, you know, memorizing words and having a Black Law dictionary. And that, living in Florida, everybody was learning how to fix air conditioners. You know, that was the big thing. There's no higher education. There's no complex thought. And that helps you understand and navigate your environment. That ability to facilitate higher thought and be able to reason and deduce. And it's not just based on experience. You also have to have the neurological capability to do that. And that's something that's taught. I have two small children. They just run right into the wall. Obviously, they don't have good, they don't understand consequence. They don't understand that what they're doing right now is going to affect what's about to happen to them or might happen to them later this evening or even into tomorrow. And we're not getting any of that.
Well, it's education, if you translate it into what it really means, it just means indoctrination. And people don't know where public schooling came from. They don't realize that it was the Prussians versus the French in a war prior to World War One, where the Prussians had public schooling and they had huge quantities of these brainwashed, mind-controlled, state-loving children coming out of these schools in order to go onto the fronts, whereas the French didn't, and the French got the pants beaten off them. And after that happened, every major Western government went, whoa, we need public schools. And in the United States, the very first public schools, children, I've seen actually like old black and white grainy footage of this. Children being dragged by soldiers on horseback with ropes from their parents to go to public school, right? That is what public school really is, ladies and gentlemen. It is a place that you are forced to go by your tyrannical government so that they can brainwash you, so that they can use you later on as cannon fodder, basically.
Absolutely. And now that this initiative has come to the forefront, since this State of the Union, everyone is, I'm seeing a lot of movement in media about homeschooling. It's like all of a sudden now when he's introducing universal preschool, now that the ball is about to hit the floor, it dropped already, it's about to hit the floor, now you act. Now all of a sudden parents are scrambling to homeschool.
It's ironic that they talk about universal preschool and universal health care, but they don't teach you nothing about the universe. And how it really works.
Yes, absolutely.
Suzanne Pozel from OccupyCorporatism.com. Thank you very much for this little news break here. And after the break, I believe Mike Sparks will be talking about how 007, James Bond himself, was actually a real person. We'll be right back after the break at TheVinnieEastwoodShow.com. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's the lighter side of genocide. We're broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island changed nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy because everybody managed to snap up a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest is Mike Sparks. Welcome to the program, Mike.
Glad to be here.
Why don't you elucidate? Or Illuminati about yourself to the audience and myself.
My name is Mike Sparks, and I'm the author of James Bond is Real. And this book is about how Ian Fleming really was James Bond. We take his novels and some of the movies, because he was involved in the movies until Goldfinger in 1964, as a writer and a consultant. And we show that Ian Fleming really was James Bond, that he had experiences in World War II that caused him to write. But what people don't realize is that after the war, he was still in the Naval Reserves. And when he was working with Kelmsley Newspapers, running their foreign department, he actually was running a spy ring. So Ian Fleming is writing in code in his novels, his fictional novels, and he's trying to tell us truths without getting himself killed. So Ian Fleming and what he writes are true. He says himself, everything I write has a precedent in truth. But he's under, you know, the Official Secrets Act, and if he would write openly, just say, hey, the Nazis escaped, they're in Argentina and Antarctica, let's go get them, in under where they're hiding in underground bases, he would be found dead the next morning. So he's trying to warn us about these secret society groups and their false flag attacks that they are instigating, even UFOs, and he's doing it without getting himself killed. James Bond, the actual character, is a role model for us. He's trying to tell us to be like James Bond, get off our butts and go look and find out where these secret evil groups are and defeat them. He started becoming a threat to the powers that be as his novels became worldwide famous. And so even his death is suspicious. So I'm ready to talk about all those interesting things.
But, proceed.
Okay. Well, the first thing that comes to mind, if you were watching you know, any World War II movie, or if you then went back to, let's say, a good World War II book, and it takes you a long time just to figure out what the hell happened in World War II. So many things are happening. Why did they do this? Why did they do that? So let's just say you take the regular view of history that both, you know, Axis and Allies were trying to win the war. Even if you take that, the both sides are playing to win, it just doesn't work. You have moments in World War II where Germany is about ready to encircle the British Army at Dunkirk, and they let them go. You have situations where all they have to do is take Gibraltar, and they close the Mediterranean, and they've got North Africa, and then they could roll into the Middle East and take the oil. There are so many events like that in World War II which defy logic. For instance, the Germans didn't even take Murmansk, where we sent all the Lend-Lease stuff to the Russians. And all they had to do was go like 15 miles. So it wasn't a priority. So you have to ask the question.
What was the name of that place, Murmansk?
Murmansk is a port in you know, northern Russia, you know, where the ice is finally breaks free. You know,
so it has nothing to do with mermaids.
Did I just didn't pronounce hear what you pronounced right? Mermaids, you said.
Mermaids.
Oh, I don't know what that is. I just think Murmansk.
A half fish, half human.
Oh, okay. No. I didn't know. Think about that. No, this is not going into the speculation that much. At this point, we're going just from sound history of the world that basically you have with Hitler, you know, pulling back every time he could have succeeded and just won the war outright. So one of your countrymen, Greg Hallett, has written a book, his best book, in my opinion, called Hitler Was a British Agent, where he outlines the suspicious background of Hitler, that he was really working for the Rothschild Illuminati all through the war to keep the war going. Now, this sounds like speculation and all that, but we go straight to Anthony Sutton, and he's got a book called The Order, many books about how Wall Street put Hitler into power. But I direct the listeners to American-Buddha.com, and you go to their website, you can read Anthony Sutton's book, The Order, and he shows that the world has been operating by a concept called thesis and antithesis, the Hegelian dialect, and the thesis was Marxist Germany, Marxist Russia, then they needed a foil, which we created Nazi Germany, the Rockefeller Illuminati money made the Nazi Germany happen. The two sides would fight each other to the death, and at the end of World War II, we would have to synthesize the problems of trying to either be socialist or fascist and create a new world order. So the Illuminati playbook is to deliberately instigate wars. And Ian Fleming points that out in his novels, that things are not what they appear to be. And you have to decode both sides and see what they're doing. And don't be surprised if they're working for both sides. The bad guys will help either side to keep them in the game, so to speak.
what I find very interesting is that the plot behind almost every movie is that the bad guy is actually playing both sides, pretending to be the good guy and doing all the bad stuff and betraying everybody in the background. And yet, when you tell people, look, the government's corrupt, or they're doing this in secret or whatever, even though they've seen it a million times, they don't believe it.
Yeah, they don't want to believe in synarchy. You know, the idea of secret elites are actually planning the world's events. Now, if FDR said nothing happens in politics by accident. But what we're talking about, and I want to be crystal clear, is that your elected officials of your nation states are not running the world. They're not coming together and having a little meeting and a confab and saying, we're going to do this, we're going to do that. No, we're not going to do this. Yes, we're going to do that. And having little arguments. No, we're talking about secret groups are going away off to some rural location like Bohemian Grove or some castle in England. And when they're not having their little orgy like you saw in Eyes Wide Shut, they're having a little, a chalkboard or a little more modern digital board or, you know, dry erase board. They're planning what they're going to do behind the scenes from the false hat that they're wearing. They're supposed to be, let's say, head of the G8, or they're the head of this economic community, or they're head of this nation state. They're not actually playing the role that the people that elected them expect. They're playing a role that's driven by, I would say, three different entities. The secret societies, the Illuminati, run the world. They're at the top. You've got the banksters, and then underneath them, the intelligence agencies. These three levels are above your nation-state governmental leaders like President Obama, anybody like that. And if you don't understand that there are three levels above the apparent government of the world, you'll never figure out world history. You'll never figure out World War II. But if people think that this is all speculative, just look into how Hitler cut a deal with Stalin to start World War II. Most people will define World War II starting with the invasion of Poland. Hitler talked to Stalin behind the scenes. He's a nation-state government leader, and said, I will give you half of Poland. You let me take the other half. So if they don't think that underhanded things don't happen, just go to the non-aggression pact between Hitler and Stalin, and thank God that thing broke up. Because if that had continued and Hitler had allowed Stalin to join the Axis, we would have been in deep trouble. And that difference, that change that caused, which was basically by Neville Chamberlain saying, we're going to defend Poland, cause Hitler and Stalin to go into bed together like that. The question is, who put Neville Chamberlain up? And the best I can see is that somebody at MI5 accused Neville Chamberlain of being a pussy, a wimp, and that so infuriated him, Chamberlain went ahead and made a boast that he was going to defend Poland. That turned the plan of the Illuminati, which is Marxist Russia and Nazi Germany thesis and antithesis, that was the original plan A of World War II. So even as that plan was going to unfold, somebody threw a monkey wrench in it. And apparently it's from somebody from MI5 telling Neville Chamberlain to do this. Now, why in the hell is MI5 telling Neville Chamberlain to do anything? They're supposed to be the internal security of England. MI6 is supposed to be in charge of figuring out what the foreign nations of the world are doing. Why is Neville Chamberlain taking advice from, you know, like the FBI, when he should be taking advice on foreign matters from somebody like the OSS? You see what I mean? So You see in history a lot of these sabotage, these backstabs taking place. So the average citizen can't really, with justification, live with his blinders on.
Yeah, and most people don't know that, I believe Nazi Germany did a deal with Stalin as well, that the Russians would invade Finland for them, and they did indeed.
Yes, that was part of the deal, yes. They would take Finland. Now, the Finns stood up to the Russians, and they got more respect out of it than what the Poles did. The Poles, in my opinion, should have said to Hitler, you know, go for it, dude. You want to go kill yourself, you know, with Hitler, and run into Stalin? You want to follow him? Go for it. they didn't win any brownie points from this, you know, the Marxists, when finally they started winning and went across, you know, Poland towards Germany. They didn't get any respect out of the Russians. They wouldn't even go come to the aid of the Warsaw Rebellion, the Russians. They just let the Nazis wipe out the Jewish people in the Warsaw ghetto, and then they continued their little march on to Nazi Germany headquarters, you know, Berlin. But you would also be good to read the book Icebreaker by Viktor Suvorov. In that book, he said the whole idea of Stalin's plan, grand strategic plan, was to let Nazi Germany weaken itself and do the groundbreaking, or in this case, icebreaking for him, by taking on the Western democracies. And then Hitler, once he was all weak, he would be easily pushed out of the way by Stalin. So in other words, this author, his name is Viktor Suvorov, that's his pen name, and his actual name is Vladimir Rezin. He's a former GRU military intelligence guy who defected to the West. He's warning us that Stalin's plan was let us weaken ourselves, and then he was going to roll in and take over all of Europe. So this evil that we talk about is not speculation. It's actual world events, and it continues to the present day, because the people who put Nazi Germany and communist Russia into power, the American Wall Street Illuminati bankers, secret societies, and intelligence agencies, they're in power today, turning the United States into a police state. All warned about by Ian Fleming.
Well, they're the hand that churns the meat grinder.
Well, right, and that was where the synthesis comes at the end of World War II. The synthesis comes that, whoa, we cannot, in the nuclear age, tolerate a Pearl Harbor. Now, Ian Fleming was involved with Pearl Harbor. Let's not make any bones about it. If England does not get America on its side, they go down. So the British intelligence knew the Japanese code. They had broken the Japanese codes. They knew the Japanese were coming, and so did FDR. FDR had broken the JN-25 codes through his naval intelligence. So key people like FDR, General Marshall, the Secretary of War, they all were very hard to get on that day, including MacArthur in the Philippines. A lot of people say, what the heck was he doing? It was a different kind of false flag attack. That's where you bait your enemy and say, look, come and attack us. We're weak. We got all these old obsolete battleships parked in rows. You know, they're not really obsolete, but that's just a picture that they're giving. Come bomb them. We knew the Japanese were coming. We moved the fleet from San Diego to Pearl Harbor so that they would attack us, because only a direct attack on the United States would cause the American sheeple, that's the way the American people are, to have enough of a blood rage to enter World War II. Without, you know, Japan attacking America, and then Hitler by treaty being obliged to declare war on the United States also, there's no way the American people would have entered war against Nazi Germany. Nazi Germany is a high technology threat that if we didn't enter the war soon and start marching on Germany, taking over their ground, taking over the actual high tech weapons laboratories, which Joseph Farrell is the best guy for describing that. You could read his book, Reich of the Black Sun. General Eisenhower at the end of the war said another six weeks, I forget which one it was, we would have been toast. The fact that we were overcoming these labs, taking out their high technology weapons before they could get weapons of mass destruction, mass produced, it was a near run thing. So the people, the neocons, say, well, we're just doing another Pearl Harbor here with 9/11. We had to stage 9/11 to get the American sheeple mad at the Islamic ragheads. Well, I'm sorry, it's not the same.
Well, it seems to me that, you know, nobody is ever really that creative that they can just make stuff up off the top of their head. It's always based on something. And I don't think
James Bond. People are smart. Yeah.
James Bond ain't no exception. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com with Mike Sparks.
Accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone.
Welcome back.
If your time to you is worth...
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that definitely, definitely assures you that the times are changing, for better or worse. Dunno. We seem to have lost our guest, Mike Sparks, just bringing him back up. Mike, yeah, you dropped off for just a second there. Welcome back.
Yes, how are you doing?
I'm somewhat fabulous. Just want a standard response anyway.
All right, well, that's good. You were talking about the enlightened amateurs, you know, in World War II, the people like Ian Fleming, General Gavin, Matthew Ridgway, all these people that at the last segment we were talking about how they can't make this stuff up. Well, the reason why they didn't make this stuff up is they were directly involved. World War II was the last chance, the last time we've had where the powers that be let enlightened individuals, enlightened amateurs like Ian Fleming run the show. And what happened is it ruined Plan B. Plan A was Nazi Germany and Communist Russia to kill each other. Then that was changed to, you know, going west and knocking out the Western allies. But the enlightened amateurs came back with such a fury with so many good ideas like the OSS, which Ian Fleming helped create, Office of Strategic Services, the need for intelligence agency. You can go to, you know, our website, jamesbondisforreal.com. You can see the documents Ian Fleming wrote to actually launch the OSS. All these things happened, and we became very good at war quickly, and we ended World War II on a positive note. The Illuminati were not fully happy. The Hitler experiment didn't work. And so they said in synthesis, right, that we should never let this happen again. So this is where a huge backstab took place. At the end of World War II, we got rid of the OSS. Isn't that weird? We just had a war where we were surprised, supposedly, by the Japanese Pearl Harbor attack. The OSS is fabulously successful. So Truman closes it down. Isn't that pretty suspicious? Now, we have a new James Bond movie out now called Skyfall, where an intelligence spy network is taken down. That's the theme of the movie. Well, you don't have to go to a fictional movie to see this happening. In 1945, it happened for real. The entire spy agency of the United States was taken down by Truman, which I'm, you know, researching for the next book, James Bond is Real 2, Bodyguard of Spies, as a sequel to, you know, the book we got now, James Bond is Real, The Untold Story of Political, Military, Technological Threats Ian Fleming Warned Us About. That's a mouthful, isn't it? Anyway, I'm writing the sequel and trying to figure out why did Truman do it. And it's very, very fishy. We've got one side saying he was jealous of William Donovan, General Donovan, the leader of the OSS, because his daughter, he was flirting with her, to where he was just afraid of his power. All to what I think the real reason is that we had a Nazi takeover in the United States. The Rockefeller Illuminati were not happy with what way, you know, Hitler experiment failed. So they knew that the country would have a mood switch, you know, mood change. So they said, we're going to go ahead, take advantage of it. And the right wing, you know, backlash against the liberals, you know, the FDR, Truman was supposed to be part of that group. Actually, he wasn't. And there's a lot of suspicious signs that Alan Dulles, the Nazi traitor who was with the OSS in Switzerland, that FDR was going to try him for treason at the end of war because he had taped recordings of Dulles while he was in New York City operating out of OSS headquarters there with the BSC doing the eavesdropping, British Security Coordination, the man called Intrepid. But that didn't happen, obviously, because FDR suddenly died. So the thing that you want to do is stay healthy, because if you do something like, you know, smoke too much, drink too much, like FDR did and Ian Fleming did, it's easy for somebody to knock you off, and then it'll look like it was a heart attack. But the evidence seems to be that somebody snuck into Warm Springs, which is over here in our neck of the woods, Georgia, and poisoned FDR. There was no autopsy done. So it looks like they manipulated their man, Truman, to become vice president. And this is talking about, you know, like 90 days, 93 days before the election. They switch out the second man, you know, which was going to be Henry Wallace, who was a very moral guy, a pro-democracy guy. At the end of World War II, a president like him would have had all of the countries that were former colonies declare their independence and get on their feet with self-determination. He was a guy who talked democracy, he preached it, but he also would act on it. Well, they switched him out for Truman just 3 months before the election. And then, lo and behold, the election, and then FDR is murdered. You know, I'm sorry, died. Very fishy. It's standard operating procedure. When you do a coup d'etat, a covert one, you switch out the number two man. That means that you're going to knock out the number one guy. Have you ever heard of that before?
Well, yeah, it sounds like a same kind of operation that goes on in the school playground, except it's called a coup d'etat.
Coup d'etat. Well, very good. Well, the thing is, if that will resonate with the people, if the people will say, look, in low-level life, we have people doing backstabs. You know, what makes you think that just because someone enters government service that they get this infusion of morality? I mean, obviously, I'm a military guy. I've been to basic training, officer and enlisted. I mean, there's no point where you're doing push-ups and you're reading the Ten Commandments. You know what I mean? There's no way where they're inculcating any morality in you.
Get down and give me Ten Commandments.
Give me Ten Commandments now. And if you don't get them right, you're going to keep doing push-ups until you do. I mean, that doesn't happen.
What are you going to do? Train somebody how to kill and at the same time train them that you shouldn't kill?
Yes. Thou shalt not kill. Okay, this is the M16 air-cooled, gas-operated shoulder weapon. It fires.
You can mess up some motherfuckers with this hardware, man.
Well, they've realized that that was not a good thing. If you have the hired help take over the operation, they might actually fight the war to win it and to win it quickly with the most efficiency. So at the end of World War II, they said, we can't do that. So what do you think they did? They got rid of the OSS. And Truman, such a liar. He's on my hit list. Truman is a bag of feces. He's our worst president.
I heard Truman look, if you had to just kill 250,000 people, how long would it take you to go, okay, all right, you know, let's do it? Truman took a couple of minutes or something like that, maybe even less, in order to say, yep, yes, bomb Hiroshima, bomb Nagasaki, even while the Japanese were trying to surrender.
You hit the right point, and Winston Churchill even said this. You know, why did we drop the nuclear bomb when they were already ready to throw a towel in? Primarily because the Russians had entered the war, and they were surrounded. We had surrounded the home islands with sea mines, which they couldn't deactivate. They were being firebombed by regular B-29 bombers. No, we put all this effort into the nuclear bomb. We were going to damn well use it and also tell the world we're the baddest dog in the neighborhood. That's why we dropped the nuclear bomb. It's very evil. Truman is not, you know, this populist man of the people. He was definitely under control of the military-industrial complex. So when he said, I took the OSS down because I'm afraid it will become an American Gestapo, well, what do you think he did 2 years later? Two damn years later, he actually hired back the entire General Reinhard Gehlen's Nazi apparatus, all of his agents in the Far East, and put together the CIA. He wrote signed the document creating the CIA, which actually has actual Nazis in it. You know, over 50% of the damn thing is full of Nazis. And the American CIA needs to be disbanded. I don't know how many more treasonous acts they need to do where the American people finally wake up and realize this organization is working for Wall Street. They're working for the Illuminati. They are not supporting democracy around the world. They're just supporting American business interests. So if you don't have people willing to understand synarchy, and it's the Rockefeller Illuminati, you just say Wall Street and they'll get it. But they're not working for we the people. And part of the synthesis that we talked about with Anthony Sutton, is that you create a problem and then you demand its solution. So you have this problem of a sneak attack on your nation state. The American sheep will say, yeah, but we need a CIA. I say, yeah, but we don't need the CIA to do it. We need an intelligence agency that needs to be moral, that works for the best interests of we the people, not the elites, and it needs to be have government oversight from Congress. So what organization would that? We had it. It was called the Office of Strategic Services. We had the OSS. Ian Fleming helped create the OSS. So at the end of World War II, there were a lot of these backstabs taking place. Now, your listeners are probably aware that Germany did not fall quickly, and there was plenty of time for people to get out. Now, the way to look at it is geographically. The Russians are coming from the east. We're coming from the west. There are people criticizing that we're taking too damn long to get there, and that's probably true. We didn't you know, rush headlong into Berlin to take the place down for many reasons. One is we'll let the Russians do most of the dying. The Russians and the Germans, that was where the most intense fighting was taking place. But if you look at the map, you'll notice up to the top, the northern part of Germany was open all the way to the end of the war. You could have went from Denmark to Norway to any part of the globe, and that is your escape route. Now, people will get all wrapped around the axle of Hitler escaping. That's true. It looks like he did escape. But the main guy that was the most dangerous was Martin Bormann. And I went with the book along the thesis that, look, let's look at Ian Fleming, put everything together, see everything that he did, and then what he could have done. And there is a bunch of evidence that Ian Fleming led a mission to Berlin in 1945 as it was surrounded by the Russians, parachuted into a lake, and from that lake operated kayaks, went up the river, and took out Martin Bormann. And Greg Hallett says he also took out Hitler using small, you know, short takeoff and landing airplanes. So Ian Fleming actually did James Bond missions.
Wow. Well, that's quite astounding. And Ian Fleming was a MI6 or MI5 agent?
He was both. He was an MI6 agent and a Naval Intelligence Division agent. So he was working for Naval Intelligence as a commander in World War II, but before World War II as a journalist, and after World War II as a quote unquote journalist, he's working for MI6. Reuters is owned by MI6, and Kelmsley Newspapers, where he was operating the foreign branch, he was working directly for MI6.
Mm. All right. So, if anybody ever tells you that President Truman was a real good guy and he, you know, ended the war or whatever, it's just a Truman show. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Welcome back. Everyone's asleep. Welcome back to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that goes where others fear to tread. And, we try not to attack people on this show. We just kind of bring them on and let them say whatever the heck they want to say. And I don't have a whole lot of discernment, honestly, ladies and gentlemen. If you email me and say, Vinny, I want you to interview this person, I won't look at their website. I won't watch their videos. I won't listen to their radio shows. I'm not going to read their books. I'm just going to interview them and hear from the horse's mouth the people who do those radio shows and write those books and make those videos. I'd rather speak to them and find out what they're all about from their own mouth. That's my research. And I think it's a lot of fun because I get to talk to some very interesting people, like my very special guest, Mike Sparks. And as Truman said, in case I don't nuke you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Well, how are you doing, Vincey?
I'm kind of actually feeling quite jazzercised today.
All right, well, that's good. We were talking before about Ian Fleming actually doing commando operations. This is one of the things that bugs me, is there's a lot of character assassination going on over the years against Ian Fleming. It started as soon as he died. Someone who is supposedly his close friend wrote a biography of him. It was going to be an autobiography, but he died. But anyway, it attacked him, making him into a lounge lizard kind of guy. Well, that is part of the establishment trying to put the genie back in the bottle, because he became a threat. He started inspiring people to act like James Bond, and then if anyone actually did this, they would find out some dangerous stuff and realize it was real. So to do this, they attacked him as saying that he was just making this up out of his head. Well, the first thing I want to stress is that he was only in Jamaica in Goldeneye for 3 months of the year. The other 9 months of the year, he's in London with Kelmsley Newspapers running their foreign office and going overseas himself, spying. So when Ian Fleming talks about James Bond going overseas and going to the hotels and eating the lavish food, he's trying to tell you without being a braggart, that's him. He's doing that. And he's working for MI6, Military Intelligence. And he worked for those guys until he died in 64. But let's go back to World War II. During World War II, another thing that they attacked him was that he was a paper pusher. Well, Ian Fleming knew the ultra secret. That was that we had broken the German codes and we were able to read their mail and their transmissions. And so we cheated basically to win World War II. Now, we couldn't have Ian Fleming going on a commando mission and getting captured and then they torture him, and he reveals the ultra secret, right? But at the end of World War II, he damn well could have, and it's entirely logical that that's what he did. At the end of the war, he went ahead and he said, I want to participate in this mission more completely, and if they capture me, Germany's falling, so there's no threat on the ultra secret. So he participated with John Ainsworth Davis, who's also got a pen name of Christopher Crichton, and they participated in the operation, quote-unquote, James Bond, which was in his mind before he created the character. He was already thinking about that name to use it as the name for the operation. They went into Berlin, like we talked about, with parachutes and kayaks, busted Martin Bormann out through kayaks, and Greg Hallett, your New Zealand comrade of yours, says that when Ian Fleming was called away from the kayak exfiltration, he actually went by small boat to another lake, a seaplane version of the Ju-52 Junkers, you know, Iron Annie, landed with Hannah Reich, and out comes Adolf Hitler and Eva Braun from a mini-submarine. And then they switched planes to a Lysander. Ian Fleming flew in the Lysander, and Hannah Reich followed with the Ju-52, and they flew Hitler to Spain. So whether you agree or not, the facts are you've got to look in your mind's eye that there are several theories of how Hitler escaped and several theories of how Bormann escaped. But the basic ones are geography driven. Either they went west to Spain, okay, or the latest book out says he went north to Norway and got a U-boat and then went south. I tend to believe the direct route of him flying by plane to Spain, because why did you think Hitler didn't invade Spain throughout the war? Why did he keep Spain neutral when closing the Straits of Gibraltar would have won the war for Hitler? No, Hitler always wanted a plan B, and Spain was, you know, at least a stepping stone to get out of the continent, you know, and then maybe to South America. So the fact that he kept Spain open is suspicious throughout the war. But anyway,
Was Franco in charge of Spain during World War II? Like, was that a fascist country at the time?
And I think that there's evidence that Ian Fleming – now, this is speculation on my part. Now, I haven't had a chance to track this down, but it would be something for the next book. I think Ian Fleming met with Franco and convinced him, or he met with a real hero, Admiral Canaris, who was in charge of Germany's military intelligence, the Abwehr. I think he met with either of those two guys and convinced them to keep Hitler out of Spain, because that was a critical turning point of the war. By Hitler not getting Spain or getting Spain to fight for them, they were not able to close the Mediterranean, and the Mediterranean was critical for us to use it to maneuver, take back North Africa, seal off the Middle East oil so that the Japanese, if they were smart and headed west, and the Germans were smart and headed east, the Japanese and the Germans never would have linked up. The British played the strategic game far better than Hitler did. Everyone will agree to that, even the guys that, you know, drool over the Nazi uniforms and weapons and all that sexy stuff. They will say they were bad strategists. That's putting it mildly. The British outmaneuvered them at a strategic level by keeping the Mediterranean open. So you have the escape of Hitler and Martin Bormann. You say, why would Ian Fleming, a moral man like that, do it? Well, the plan was that they were going to get back the money that they had stolen from all the concentration camp people that they had murdered, and England was desperate for that money. So if you read Christopher Crichton's book, OPJB, The Last Great Secret of World War II, who I have been in direct contact with, I've actually interviewed John Ainsworth Davis, Christopher Crichton, and had some other people working for us on our book. We've interviewed him. And if you go to that link on our YouTube channel, we have alternate YouTube channels just as backup. But if you go to the YouTube channel, James Bond is Real number 2, just James Bond is Real 2, you'll see a video on combined operations pilotage parties. The cop teams are just like SEALs that could do naval reconnaissance of the beach from mini subs and, you know, combat swimming with fins. Anyway, you'll see that Ian Fleming's second in command for the mission, John Ainsworth Davis, is a real guy. Even though he was a spy and an assassin, you know, they don't normally advertise. And you will see that during an interlude in the war where he wanted to get away from spy work, Ainsworth Davis took a time out and was a combat swimmer with COP to help out the D-Day landings. And you can go to a video there we have of the COP reunion, which just took place a few months ago in Hayland Island, England. All the surviving COP members came together, including John Ainsworth Davis. So you see the guy's a real deal. He's a real dude, real World War II commando. And the British, you know, monarchy sent, you know, Ms. Mountbatten, you know, Lady Mountbatten was there to commemorate the event. So he's a legitimate guy. He's made movies in Hollywood. You can go to our other website, James Bond is Real, or Denny McPara 2. You can see videos we have of John Ainsworth Davis. He was basically, after the war, using, I don't know what you would call it, it's sort of Hollywood. He's working for, you know, The Saint, you know, TV show as a director. He's making some B-movies with, you know, Luciana Paluzzi. Do you know her? The red-haired girl from Thunderball?
Nah.
Hot chick. You got to watch Thunderball and look at the redhead chick. She's hot. Luciana Paluzzi. He filmed her in a movie. He's basically using his, I'm going to call it Pinewood, you know, instead of Hollywood, his Pinewood movie experience after World War II to spy. So John Ainsworth Davis is spying for NATO after World War II using his movie, you know, career as an excuse to go all over the, you know, the world and spy. So he's an amazing guy. And so I tend to believe in what I call the greatest common denominator view of Ian Fleming. He really was James Bond. He really did go on commando missions. He wasn't bitter and all that because he wasn't rich and famous. He was a man of action. He loved women. He was not a misogynist. That's another one that gets on my nerves. He loved and adored women. You can see that in his writings and his novels. For instance, when Kissy Suzuki and him hooked up, you know, his character, James Bond, hooked up, he wanted to help her out from her family problems. You also had Honey Rider had some facial problems. You know, I think her nose was deformed in a fight. He paid for her. James Bond paid for her plastic surgery. So I hate those people who say that James Bond was a misogynist. Ian Fleming certainly wasn't. His character in the books wasn't. But the point is that World War II, while it was underway, he couldn't go on commando missions until it was safe to do so. But he did create an assault unit called 30 Assault Unit, which went on commando raids to collect intelligence. And that intelligence-gathering commando unit was inspired by Otto Skorzeny. I sent you a picture of him. Otto Skorzeny was a SS commando leader, and Hitler had very high confidence in him because he actually busted Mussolini out of Italy by landing gliders on a mountaintop retreat, taking down the guards, putting Mussolini and himself in a Fischler Storch stole plane, taking off the mountain. So this guy was like James Bond, Otto Skorzeny. He had his own commando unit. Ian Fleming said, we need something like that, and he created 30 Assault Unit. There's even a movie out that came out a few years ago, which didn't go into detail. I'd like to, but anything helps, showing that Ian Fleming was in charge of the unit and sent him on missions. It's called The Age of Heroes. It stars, the guy from Sean Bean, who is in GoldenEye playing a villain. So there's a little James Bond connection going on there. But people are starting to realize that Ian Fleming really was the real deal, and I think they're trying to put the cork back in the bottle again. I did not like the movie Skyfall. Have you seen that?
I did.
Yeah, I hated
it. I thought it was probably the most awesome James Bond film yet, personally. But
well, I guess that makes me kind of unique here. I'm the only one that seems to realize that the movie was an anti-James Bond movie. Because if you look at the movie, and if you haven't seen it, don't listen to what I'm going to say because there's spoilers. The movie is about killing MI6. First, you kill MI6 competence in the beginning of the movie having Bond get shot. No one would have ordered someone to shoot through, you know, James Bond to get to the bad guy. Like you saw in the beginning in the train scene. You would have waited until there was a shot, a clear shot. Anyway, then they killed off the girl. James Bond, it's about is the light coming to the aid of the fair maiden. There was no reason that they killed the girl off. Daniel Craig could have done his martial arts moves before the villain shoots the girl, who is supposed to be rescued from the Chinese triads or whatever, Illuminati drug and prostitution ring that she was part of. And then they killed MI6 head, M. for no reason. They killed her all throughout the movie for her reputation and her skill as being incompetent, and then they actually killed her off. And there was even a smart aleck remark in the movie where it says, well, we still maybe have a few friends in the CIA. I think that the movie Skyfall is a retribution for the last movie, Quantum of Solace, where they clearly took shots at the CIA. If you remember seeing Quantum of Solace, they said, this is another CIA operation to just grab the resources here in South America. They took a lot of shots at the CIA, which are deserved. And I think if you notice, there was a time period at the end of Quantum of Solace and Skyfall, there was no funding to make the James Bond movie. Remember, there was a hard time coming up with the money to make another James Bond movie. And then the money does appear, and it comes from Sony, right? What does Sony stand for? Standard Oil of New York. Sony is a Rockefeller Illuminati company, and they put a hack writer on the team. The normal Purvis and Wade team receives another author to write the script, and the whole script is anti-British intelligence. And you have these little slide remarks in there, and it seems to me that they cut some kind of deal that says, yeah, we'll fund another James Bond movie, but we want one of our screenwriters, you know, on board. And I hated the movie, totally. I hate that movie. It's the worst James Bond movie, if you ask me, Skyfall. But I don't say anything public about it yet until now. You're the first I've heard of it from me, is because I don't want to hurt the franchise. You know, you want people to buy the movies in DVD form, and you want them to go to the movie theater. But I got to tell you, I went to Walmart, and the Skyfall DVDs are not selling because it's an unpleasant movie. I don't think it's a very good movie. It's a oneer. You go to see it one time, and that's it. It's the rest of the James Bond movies you can watch again and again.
It is actually probably one of the darker James Bond films that I've ever seen, and I think. Well, actually, probably I think the best part of that movie was the performance of Dame Judi Dench, just really hard-boiled kind of intelligence section chief, really.
Yeah, she did a fine job, and she made a very good case that they're in a difficult job, and she's got to have the prerogative to call the shots in order to get the job done, and she does get the job done and take down the network. But what I don't like is how they said that the villain was made to be the villain because she threw him under the bus during the turnover of Hong Kong to the Red Chinese. No, that was out of character. M would not have done that. No M, you know, leader of an intelligence agency is going to throw his own or her own agents under the bus for whatever reason. If the guy was misbehaving, which is what the case was, she would have recalled him. There's no reason that she had to turn him over to the Red Chinese to be tortured. But this is part of the thing, the dark side you're talking about. It was the very first thing Ian Fleming talked about. In Casino Royale, the first novel, Bond is going through this problem of, you know, torture, subterfuge, backstabbing, who can you trust? And in the whole theme of the movie, and I'll give it to you and to the readers and listeners because they may not actually read the book. The end of the book, Mathis tells James Bond to stay close to human beings, stick close to them, because they're far easier to fight for than principles, because principles can be perverted. And so the whole point of Casino Royale, Bond is saying, well, maybe we need evil, because without evil, we have nothing for good to do. We've got to tolerate it, you know, this Manichaean, you know, Carl Jungian thing. No, Mathis says bullshit. He says, we must defend our loved ones. If you have any doubt about what to do when you see these evil clowns do 911s or do World War IIs, which incidentally, Ian Fleming lost his lover, Muriel Wright got killed in a bombing attack, and that really upset him. But anyway, he of course writes about other people being lost in, you know, fictional sense. But anyway, the point is, in Casino Royale, he's telling James Bond to keep your moral compass. So the Skyfall movie, I think, failed to do that big time.
Mm-hmm. Well, see, it's amazing how everybody can view the same thing, but based upon what they know, they see a completely different thing. You know what I'm saying? We'll be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with my very special guest.
Mike Sparks, the author of James Bond is Real. And soon to come, coming, James Bond is Real too.
Coming soon.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. We're broadcasting live on AmericanFreedomRadio.com. And incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. I was hoping American Freedom Radio would play the Skyfall cover by a musician named Noah, but it doesn't look like they've got any idea how to do that. So we're going to do it myself. I'll just see if this this works here for you. Hold on a second. This is Noah, the cover of Skyfall by Adele.
This is the end. Hold your breath and come to chance. Feel the earth move and dance. Feel my heart burst again. For this is the end. I've drowned and dread this moment. So over to I owe the end. Swept away, I'm so. Security and your loving.
You gotta love that, man. Seriously.
It's beautiful.
That guy, his YouTube channel is only one, the number one Noah, N-O-A-H, only one Noah, and he does covers of so many songs. Now, synchronicity, you're familiar with this, and I'm sure you've experienced synchronistic experiences yourself. What do you think the likelihood is, Mike? Because I only organized you to come on the show just as little as yesterday, and my sister sent me this link to this song this morning just before the show.
I don't think anything happens by accident, and I think that there is a supernatural battle taking place at even a higher level than the Illuminati, you know, God versus Satan. So, yes, I think synchronicity is evidence of that higher supernatural metaphysical battle taking place.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Such a good song, and I love that guy. Okay, well, anyway, moving on from that sort of little entertainment segment, where do we go from here, do you reckon?
Well, the music's good. I think it's important that we talk about that, that the music had an excellent theme. Skyfall's theme song is that we should all stand together, and that is the best part of the Skyfall, if there's any silver lining in the cloud. It's just that we need to do a better job of it. At the end of the movie, they do basically a retelling of the Battle of Duffer's Drift. Have you ever heard of that, where the Zulus surrounded the British soldiers? It was done in 1964 with Michael Caine, Stanley Baker. And there also was a more modern version of it, is the Dog Soldiers. Do you ever see the Dog Soldiers movie, where the British Army squad is in the country and some giant werewolves attack them? But the idea is
you know what's funny? It's funny you should mention that, because just yesterday I was thinking of the movie Dog Soldiers. I haven't seen it in years, and I was like, man, I love that movie. You know, for some reason it just popped into my head.
Oh, it's not an accident. Why. It's a very cogent to what happened at the end of Skyfall, is that by choice they went to this manor where it used to be the James Bond family home to defend against the impending attack. But you have the entire weight of the British military and intelligence apparatus, and they didn't bother to bring a quick reaction force. They didn't bring any weapons. They just brought the Aston Martin. That's absolutely incompetent, absurd. You know, if the movie would have ended better if the new guy that was going to take over for M, the new Q, and everybody in the office had been, you know, rounded up as a scratch team to come rescue Bond. That would have tied in with the theme of the Adele song. You see what I'm saying? So in other words, Bond and them were getting overwhelmed, and then suddenly at the last minute, you have the new Q come in kicking ass. That would have been in line with the theme of the song. And that's what real people should do. If you really are going to defend something, you'd have a quick reaction force. You go to a place that's defendable, and you bring a bunch of equipment. I just thought that the Duffer's Drift thing, you know, was overused. You know, we're scrounging up stuff. There's no need to be scrounging weapons and explosives to defend yourself, or missiles even, to knock the helicopter down. So I wasn't happy with that. But the music's wonderful. It's beautiful. And if it was up to me, I'd re-edit Skyfall. There's a few things I would do to change the movie and fix the movie. So I'm not trying to be a negative person on that. I think Skyfall could be a director's cut, could be fixed to be more pleasant and more realistic. But not to be also a hypocrite, I've also posted online for free, I think, a better James Bond story. And I posted it in your window there. It's called The Bell Tolls for Thee. I've made it into, like, video segments. So it's fan fiction. I'm not making any money. Can't sue me. It's just a James Bond story, which I think is more in line with what Ian Fleming wanted, and it's more true to the nature of James Bond, is being a chivalrous, romantic guy saving the lady in distress. But you can go to James Bond is Real number 2 to watch The Bell Tolls for Thee. Too bad I can't give you this gobbledygook YouTube channel link. You know, YouTube should wise up and simplify their URL. So I could give you a URL simply, like, for instance, James Bond is Real 2 /video 10. I should be able to communicate to you simply where a YouTube video is. But anyway, that's
I think if you go to tinyurl.com, I can't
I can't be 100% sure of this or if I'm misremembering, but you can put in the link of what you got and it'll give you the option to either have a much smaller version of the link, or you can actually customize it and put the link as you want it.
Well, that's what you need. You need to customize it so it can be at the top of your head, some kind of coherent word like bell tolls for the three or something. You know, it's got to be something that you can recite and remember. It can't be gobbledygook. You know, and even Ian Fleming or some genius can't remember. Like, for instance, let me just read the playlist for bell tolls for the youtube.com/playlist?list equals PLSV6XBXXYUAEPG. You get the idea.
I mean, it's like freaking, it's like trying to write out the formula for pi.
Yeah, exactly. So they should simplify their URLs and they would get more viewers, more hits. You know, hint, hint, YouTube. You can't really communicate to YouTube because they're trying to say, you know, hard to get. We can't hear you. Can't hear you. So they have so many people complaining about different things of going on in YouTube. So they just play hard to get through to those guys. But getting back to the main idea of Skyfall, of a collapse of an intelligence agency, Ian Fleming, you know, is very upset about the way World War II ended. You know, at least 250,000 Germans escaped to South America and Antarctica, and I put a picture on your little IM box where there's an opening, mysterious opening in South the South Pole area. We need to investigate. Ian Fleming, frustrated by these things, writes these novels as a way of dropping hints in code for us to get off our butt and do things. So I wanted to give you a quick rundown. When you read Dr. No, it's about underground bases and secret societies like the Triads in the Far East. When you read Moonraker, it's about the Nazi scientists of Paperclip creating a missile, and oops, the missile's got a real nuclear warhead, and it's going to take out London, and there will be a stock market crash. Does that sound familiar? So he's writing this book in 1958. Anyway, he's writing this in the 50s about stock market crashes after a terrorist attack. That's in Moonraker. Incidentally, the Moonraker movie was not based on the novel, which is really bad. Too bad that the book has not really been made into a movie yet. It's probably too hard-hitting, too close to home. But if people doubt that Ian Fleming's warning us, go to read Moonraker, because that's clear. You can see that Otto Skorzeny is in the book. It's clear that the main evil guy who's pretending to be a Wernher von Braun-type scientist is actually Otto Skorzeny, an SS commando leader. So I give away the game there, but I do it because, you know, the people need to go back and read these books, you know. So I hate to give you a spoiler here, but I'm trying to show you there's more to meets the eye. When you read Goldfinger, it's about the banksters, about how they move gold around. And do you know that there's a massive movement of Germany's gold from American and French banks? If you go to the YouTube channel James Bond is Real number 2, I've got some videos showing that they discovered that the gold bars in the American Federal Reserve in New York are phony. They're platinum bars covered with a thin sheath of gold, and the German people are furious. They're so angry they're demanding all their gold be returned because basically it's swindled.
Wait. Not platinum, tungsten. Platinum's worth even more than gold. If they were wrapping platinum with gold, the Germans would be like, sweet!
Sweet! No, you're right. It's tungsten. That's right. I made it read a spelling error right here. That's right. It's tungsten. Oop, beep, beep. But
the reason why they use tungsten is because it is almost the exact same weight per size as gold.
Right. And so the idea with the French is that they can't cough up a bunch of gold. So they've invaded Mali, which is rich in gold. So the Mali expedition suddenly to take on these Islamic ragheads is really a subterfuge. They're really going down there to get some gold quick to try to keep the Germans happy. Now, they've given themselves time. They say, hey, this stuff is heavy. You know, that's the whole theme of Goldfinger. When you watch the movie or read the book, they're differing in their storylines. In the book, they move the gold by train to a Soviet cruiser. In the movie, they say, well, it's too heavy to move. We're just going to irradiate it. So that's a truth. And the idea is that they're using the heavy excuse to give them time to cough up some new gold to appease the Germans. Isn't that a stinker?
Yeah.
Seem like you're totally aware of that, and that's good.
And now, speaking of gold and the Germans and things of that nature, wasn't George W. Bush's grandfather, Senator Prescott Bush, involved in a massive kind of like gold smuggling for the Nazis sort of thingamajig in New York during World War II?
Yeah, he was tried and found guilty of trading with the enemy, so he should have been tried for treason, but by getting rid of FDR, they conveniently took out the guy who will go after him at the end of the war. So he is part of the Anthony Sutton depiction. If you could go to American-Buddha.com, read how Wall Street could finance Hitler, you'll see that Union Banking, which Prescott Bush was the president of.
Right, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, and you can go to many banks in Switzerland and in New York and say, oh, I'd like to open an account. And they go, what with? Nazi gold! We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Yeah. Welcome back.
And no one like me.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's our final segment with Mike Sparks, the author of James Bond is Real, and soon, James Bond is Real too. Kind of like Look Who's Talking and Look Who's Talking To.
Yeah, good.
Look Who's an Agent, Look Who's Another. Yeah, okay.
I wanted to round
this off with? Sorry.
Yeah, I want to correct it. I was not Duffer's Drift. That's a U.S. military version defensive scenario. It's Rourke's Drift. That the Dog Soldiers and Skyfall and Zulu were talking about. It's a Battle of Rourke's Drift. I was getting confused with the American version of that. But anyway, the idea is that they're fighting a rear guard action in a building against overwhelming numbers of bad guys. But the ending of that is symbolic of kind of what Ian Fleming's talking about. He's trying to find where the bad guys are and fight them in their base instead of us being on a defensive. We want to be on offense. So as his career came to an end, he wrote the final book, The Man with the Golden Gun. And that book has got symbolism and secret messages in it, which I think show that he's very upset about President Kennedy being assassinated a year before, and that the CIA did it through Alan Dulles, the traitor who probably took out FDR also. So in the book, he starts off with James Bond being mind controlled. Ian Fleming has the hero of his novels, James Bond, go to the office in London and try to kill M. But before that happens, secret bulletproof glass comes down and he's stopped. But what he's trying to tell the reader is that you can be mind controlled. People who don't want to do things can be made to murder against their will, which was what we're seeing today all across the United States with these so-called massacre shootings. These people with supposedly mental problems going to psychiatrists and getting help. Yeah, they're getting help, all right. They're being turned into Manchurian candidates, MK Ultra people to instigate these massacre shootings so that we can have a pretext to take guns away from the American public. So Ian Fleming is a man of the time trying to warn us about things. I wanted to end with the most radical. When you remember the movie and the book Thunderball, the yacht that was operated by the evil Largo is called the Disco Volante. That means flying saucer. So you have, throughout the novels, Ian Fleming is dropping hints that the powers that be have these craft, these flying saucers. And I sent you a picture of the 1952 UFOs flying over Washington, D.C., which spooked Truman. The message there was that in 1947, Truman sent a task force down to Antarctica with Operation High Jump under Admiral Byrd. They got their butts kicked. And so this is the Germans sending a signal to Washington, back off with a show of force. I think if you go back into the 1947 Roswell incident and the 1947, slightly earlier, Maury Island incident, that the actual cover story is the E.T. cover story. They actually want you to think E.T. is visiting us because they don't want you to know that these are actually human beings in anti-gravity craft that are flying around and they're not you know, vanquished Nazis. They're still on the loose.
There was a incident, I believe, during World War II, where British pilots were flying over a particular area. I forget what the area is called, but there were remarkably large amounts of unidentified flying craft that were reported by British pilots back to headquarters, and they traced it back to this this mountain complex that the Nazis had that was only accessible by a river. There were no roads in or anything like that, and there was a British force that was sent in of commandos to take out this facility, and as soon as they infiltrated and took control of the facility, all these unidentified craft sightings stopped.
Well, you got the right idea. It's what you call an apocryphal story. You don't have the exact details, but the essence of it is correct, which is the Germans were fond of building underground bases. That's what Ian Fleming's trying to tell you. The underground base thing and the UFO thing is German Nazi-oriented, and they escaped. He can't say it openly or he's going to be killed. But I wanted to give you one clue. Okay, I'll give you one of my secrets away in the book. The main evil organization in the beginning of the books were SMERSH, you know, Soviet Military Intelligence Assassination Bureau, right? But then as the books progressed, he switched to SPECTRE. Okay, you know, it's an acronym, SPECTRE. I'm saying SPECTRE is not an acronym. You take the word SPECTRE and take the last two letters off, R-E, put R-E in front of SPECTRE, what do you get? You get the word RESPECT. Ian Fleming is telling you that the Nazis are SPECTRE. Respect is all that the Nazis were after. The whole point of World War II was to gain respect because of the loss of World War I. The very essence of Nazi fascism is respect. They want the rest of the world to drool over them, to think that they're the superior being. So Ian Fleming is telling you, so I've given you a secret. Respecter is the Nazis, the Rockefeller Illuminati, and their creation, the German Nazis. And then, and if you read at the end of my book, you will also see the actual openings in the South Pole area, which with, you know, GPS coordinates where we could go and actually see it, longitude and latitude coordinates, and see what the heck is underneath the ground of the South Pole area, which apparently is warm. There are geothermal warmth underneath, so the water in the Bunker Hills area is actually warm. So it seems to be a place that you could live underground. Now, the legend is that the people that went down there, the Germans that went there, through the years, they had 1943 when they knew the war was lost at Stalingrad to 1945. British intelligence through naval intelligence would probably know all the people and the ships that went down there, not just submarines. Ian Fleming would be privy to that. At the end of World War II, Ian Fleming led 30 Assault Unit to capture the German naval records. So I would love to go overseas to England and to go through the captured documents with somebody who's a translator. I know what to look for. The question is, did the Germans keep secrets to themselves internally, or did they feel safe and talk freely? Because if they talk freely, they're going to say, hey, this month we sent three ships down there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So they call this, in the legend from Landig, one of the, you know, pro-German cheerleaders, Base 211. Whatever they called it, you know, you got to keep all these clues in your mind, and then you look for them, and whenever you find something, you then free associate and say, wait a minute, I see a pattern here. They're calling it Base 211. Or, no, they're calling it the Richter Expedition. You know, what I'm saying is you've got to have in the back of your mind these factoids. And then when you go looking, you free associate with your synchronicity, like you call it. And then once you start doing that, you do pattern analysis, put the pieces together, you try to build the greatest common denominator. Voila. Next thing you know, you've got the truth. And I'm saying the truth needs to be investigated actively. The whole point of James Bond is you get your butt down there and you investigate. You don't just sit back and go to the National Archives and do Freedom of Information Act. Because who's know if they're not feeding you a line of bull? I just read something yesterday that says that there's a guy and his whole specialty is makes the sheeple feel good Freedom of Information Act request documents. That's what I do. If I were the government trying to lie to people, I'd have a guy who just could conjure up the documents they want to hear and read. So, no, we've got to actively investigate. And that's what James Bond is about. He actively goes down there, he investigates, he forces the issue, and we're not doing that. So we wonder why we don't have certainty about these things. I'm laying out areas we need to go after and actually shake the tree and see what falls from the tree. And then we'd find out the truth. But what are they doing with all this money is the main question. All right. They're basically swindling all this money through their little gold, you know, bait and switch operations, their false flag attacks. The main idea is that the Illuminati want to live forever. They are going to die just like everybody else. So they're trying to achieve immortality. Now, that's going to cost a lot of money. So basically, they're using the sweat and labor of the sheeple, us normal people, to fund these immortality experiments, these anti-gravity craft, in case the planet gets threatened by an extinction-level event. The Illuminati are just trying to save their rear end, and they need a lot of money to do it, and they need to do it in secret. And Ian Fleming lays this all out for you. He lays out for you in his novels what they're up to, and it's not a fantasy. I guess in a way it's harmful that the movies kind of do this in a tongue-in-cheek kind of way, but I think we've been blasted in the reality by events like 9/11, Sandy Hook shootings and whatnot, to where we need to reboot Ian Fleming. We need to go back, read the books again with an idea of reading what they say at the overt level and then looking for clues, you know, hidden words, and decode these words to see what he's saying. And then you'll see the basis of what I predict, you know, is going to happen in the book, you know, James Bond is Real, the first book, which is that they're going to probably do a metaphysical 9/11 attack. At some point, the people are going to say, all right, terrorism, schmerism, you're not really scaring me. Now, Von Braun, as, you know, people get older, they get, hey, I'm going to die. Maybe these Nazis aren't right. I better kind of do something moral here so God isn't mad at me. At the end, he told Carol Rosen, his assistant, that if that wore off, the terrorism threat wore off, they would move on to more scary things. And the next scary thing is asteroids, some kind of object hitting the Earth. And if that doesn't scare people, the last, you know, fear card that they can play will be E.T. The extraterrestrials are coming for us. Now, if you've got anti-gravity craft that you've been working on, which even Timothy Good, who's an E.T. guy, you know, a guy that always says everything, an E.T. under every UFO sighting, even he admits that we had anti-gravity craft working by 1962. So the Americans were having flying saucers just 10 or 15 years after the end of World War II.
Okay. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you've got to check out this book if you're a reader. Mike Sparks, and check it out. Google it. And what was it?
JamesBondIsForReal.com.
IsForReal.
The website is JamesBondIsForReal. It's just a longer name for the website.
All right. And just remember, ladies and gentlemen, if you're wondering about James Bond, just remember, it's not an accent. It's a speech impediment. Thank you very much, Mike.
Right,
for your
good,
time.
Good being on the show. Thanks.
Good man. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for your attention.